Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
You know what hearsay is? Hearsay is not evidence. Hearsay is some guy saying something. So you can, some guy told you, some guy told you, some guy said. Okay? So here's the Chicago Way hearsay rule for Mike Quigley, who embarrassed everybody by talking about it. And that is, I know a guy who knows a guy who heard it from another guy at City Hall that for year after year after year, whenever Big Bernie Hansen, the alderman of the ward that Quigley's from, would turn around, you know who you'd see? You know what you'd see? You'd see Mike Quigley sticking out of his back pocket, a tiny Mike Quigley, with his head just peering out there frightened and alone, a little inquisitive, like a baby kangaroo. Okay? We're going to talk about impeachment and the politics of impeachment with Charles Lipson, professor emeritus of the University of Chicago and writer on politics and philosophy and philosophy of government for Real Clear Politics and elsewhere. And we're also going to talk to Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, who killed it with that story about Mike Madigan's top confidant on a federal wire, Mike McLean, who worked for Commonwealth Edison? I meant Madigan Electric. And we'll also talk to Ray about the puzzling retirement of John Cullerton after 40 years running things in the Senate of Illinois. And when I heard that, you know what I thought? Because it came right after the McLean thing and some guy wrote a column about the federal bus. And you know what I thought? I thought this. All through the town. Yeah, that's what I thought. Now, who knows? Who knows? Of course, Jeff Carlin is here. He knows. He knows everything. And he's got this killer story about his uncle and Harry Truman. You got to hear it. Jeff's the executive producer of The Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis. And me, of course, I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. The guy just trying to write four columns a week and doing a podcast and keeping my head above water. And you know where you are? As you think about Faye Dunaway in Chinatown saying, my sister, my daughter, my sister, my daughter. And the wheels on the bus going round and round. And Johnny Cullerton. And Mikey Quigley like a little kangaroo sticking out of Bernie Hansen's pocket. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine. She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Hello.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
You know, like I said in that movie Chinatown, Faye Dunaway, Jack Nicholson, the rapist, child rapist, Roman Polanski with his little knife slitting people's noses. There was that memorable scene where she says, my daughter, my sister, slap, slap, slap. And I'm thinking, it's politics, it's legal, it's politics, it's legal about the impeachment. Professor Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, Real Clear Politics, and wherever you may find him, what do you think of this impeachment drama?
Forget it, John. It's Congress.
Right, Jake. Okay, Jake.
I got to tell you, it is fundamentally political, not just in the sense that all the people who are voting on it, both in the House and assuming there is an impeachment that it goes to the Senate, are political actors, but that there are no legal court rules that apply. So hearsay evidence can be admitted. I know that that's Representative Mike Quigley's favorite kind of evidence.
I think the American public needs to be reminded that countless people have been convicted on hearsay because the courts have routinely allowed and created needed exceptions to hearsay. Hearsay can be much better evidence than direct, as we have learned in painful instances, and it's certainly valid in this instance.
There is a song by Randy Newman called Good Old Boys. It says, college boys from LSU went in dumb, come out dumb too, strutting around Atlanta in their alligator shoes. Well, we got them here in Chicago, don't we?
Yeah,
the legal procedures do bear in a couple of very important senses, not in the technical legal sense, but in the broader sense that Americans care about fairness. And I think that there is a lot that they are concerned about the way that Adam Schiff and his handler, his rabbi, his clout, Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, I thought you were going to say George Soros, but
anyway. No. In fact, I find some of the conspiratorial stuff kind of very troubling,
yes,
that people are putting out without a lot of evidence in right. the public sphere. But I've got to say, you know, in Chicago, if you're a promoted policeman, it's your clout, right? In New York, that same person is called your rabbi
right.
in the police force. And Nancy Pelosi is the clout for a Schiff, so nothing's happening without her approval. But I think the fact that they
Well, you know what she said, it's all about patriotism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then on Thursday, she said everything points back to Putin. So she's in effect accusing, very much like Hillary Clinton accused Tulsi Gabbard of being a Russian asset. She didn't quite come out and say it, but that's what she's saying. Now, mind you, her guy, Barack Obama, not only didn't give lethal aid to Ukraine. He gave blankets and meals, but he didn't allow U.S. planes to fly those in. They had to fly in, I think it was to Prague, and come in kind of unmarked vehicles to the country. So it's
All
not they, as if they have clean hands.
Does that matter? No one, as you, I'm sorry to interrupt
yeah.
you, but no
yeah,
one,
yeah.
you said no one has clean hands here, right?
Well,
or they don't have
yeah,
clean hands.
Yeah, and the ones that do are like Lady Macbeth. They're washing them constantly.
Which is Nancy, if you ever go to the Capitol building after midnight, Jeff Carlin, you will see Nancy Pelosi washing her hands in the air, thinking about what she's done to Joe Biden's campaign. Because
Kneecapped it.
As Charles Lipson pointed out in a conversation before we came on the air, all this stuff minimizes and detracts from and slaughters the Biden campaign, does it not?
I mean, we were talking about this. This is like the worst played game of chess ever, political chess, because there's no upside. I mean, I understand if the whole premise is, okay, we don't want a president doing something like Trump did, regardless of whether it's illegal.
Like beating Hillary in 2016.
Well, yeah,
that's the point.
But let's take their argument at face value.
Oh.
That a president shouldn't be dealing and wheeling for his own political gain in an election setting as opposed to for the best interest of the country on a whole. Okay, so then you
that's
say
that's their strongest claim.
Right.
That's absolutely their strongest
claim. Right, and so
right.
if you take that and say, sure, okay, and run an impeachment process, which is what they're doing, but they didn't have to. They forced the hand on it, and it's going to crush them when it comes to January, February, March, April, when all these primaries are starting to come together, and there's a Senate hearings going, a Senate processes that are just making the whole thing look like a sham and a charade.
Who's the first witness that you call if you are the legal counsel for the Senate majority leader? When the trial begins, because there's going to be an impeachment, who do you call first?
Well, you obviously want the whistleblower, because you want to show that the whole enterprise was a setup. I mean, you know, you're going to want to show that this was not disinterested, because it was secondhand. There had to the whistleblower, first of all, didn't have any firsthand information. So you want to know how he got it from the White House. And that's going to lead people to think, well, wait a minute. The CIA has guys in the White House who are spying on the president and reporting back to Langley.
They've always had guys in the White House.
Reporting back to Langley, spying on the president. Well, this is the sort of thing that used to be one of the charges about J. Edgar Hoover, right? Well, we now know that Comey actually had such a person in the early days of the Trump White House. So Trump may be paranoid about leaking and all these other people, but he's got real enemies. These are not figments of his imagination. The next thing you're going to see is that the whistleblower worked with the Schiff staff. Now, Schiff says he doesn't know the name of the leaker. That would only be
because... such a lie. Come on, I'm calling it out as a lie.
There is a country song, my friend, that says if you can't lie no better than that, you might as well tell the truth. That's exactly it. And if he, quote, doesn't know, and the key word would be no, he's a lawyer, right? Would know, he's heard the name, he's seen the fingerprints, he's got the gun, but he doesn't know who did the shooting. That would only be because he told his staff, do not tell me. And who is the staff? The staff were people who served with him.
With the whistleblower.
With the whistleblower.
Yes.
On the Barack Obama and later the Trump National Security Council staff, served alongside the person we think is the whistleblower.
All this should come out. I've argued it in columns. I can't seem to get the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Chicago Tribune and others to print the name of the whistleblower. So I don't know in that sense who it is. But, you know, I read Real Clear Politics. The guy who runs it is a friend of mine and a guest here and a friend of yours too, Charles and Jeff. And Real Clear Politics put it out in a piece by Paul Sperry and outlined it.
It's a great piece in Real Clear Investigations. Paul Sperry, people should look up his name.
I linked to it in a Sunday column.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, we've talked about cancel culture. You may know that Don Jr.'s book, Triggered, is now number one on a bestseller list. Do you know that people are going in and turning all of his book covers around so that people who come into bookstores can't see the book? This is a world now that's become pervasive. It used to be on college campuses. It used to be shouting down of pro-Israel speakers or maybe anybody else they thought was a conservative. But now it's spreading to your local Barnes & Noble.
Although that book thing's been done in the past, too.
Has it?
Oh, yeah. I remember as a kid, you know, there were always kids who thought they were, you know, edgy and, you know, flipping a Ross Perot book around, or like someone, you know, some book where they would see anything. I don't want anybody to see those.
Yeah, Ross Perot got us Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you brought it up, so I have to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I wrote a column, and I'm not asking you to comment on the column, but it's the idea of cancel culture at Northwestern and at all the other universities. It's pervasive in high schools taught by in faculties where kids learn to bend the knee at an early age, and then they go to college and they bend the knee there to the politics of their professors. So I don't know why we're surprised after all this knee bending that the children of our culture at Northwestern University would abrogate their responsibilities as student journalists, fall to their knees, beg for forgiveness from the mob that was protesting and that they covered of the Jeff Sessions speech. What has happened here?
Something really nasty, and the adults who are in charge seem to be contributing rather than pulling back from it. Just so we're all on the same page about what happened at Northwestern, and I want to mention something that happened at Harvard.
It's another one.
At Northwestern, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions came to speak. Students, in effect, rioted and shouted him down and all the rest. Right. And then Northwestern,
the Daily Northwestern
at a school that has one of the top two or three journalism programs in the country, Medill School of Journalism, wrote an editorial. Go ahead.
They wrote an editorial. They pulled down the offending material that they
and the offending material included photos of
and
people in
of
a public place
at a public event who didn't want their faces apparent, or felt that they were being targeted because they were a group. There was a racial component because it was
there always is.
Well, of course,
the people who were there who were taking their photos taken felt that they were only being targeted because they were their race. In fact, they were being targeted because they were there and in a public event trying to put their voice out.
So this was like a black thing? I didn't know.
No, Hispanic. I mean, because Chestnut has the ICE connection to him, so that was what they were protesting.
Yeah. And so what we have is that Northwestern Daily, the newspaper, then apologized not for incorrect reporting, failure to apologize for that belongs to the New York Times and the Washington Post. They apologized for accurate reporting because they said it violated the number one obligation of a student newspaper, which is students feeling safe. And now what can you say about that? You can say they're young and dumb, but I was young, and there are many, many, many people who went to college with me who would agree I had extremely poor judgment in the late 1960s. It was required, my friend. You couldn't listen to Jim Morrison and the Doors and keep your head on straight.
With that naked Indian in your brain.
Hey, yeah. But here's what really represents the nadir of modern universities. Mort Shapiro, who is the president of Northwestern. Now, the president of these universities has one job and one job only, which is to separate rich alumni from their money. But in this case, he marched into this issue. And what did he say? He said, well, you know, it was a kind of a bad thing, blah, blah, blah. It happened here. And here's where he fell completely into Lake Michigan on the 1st of January and didn't come out. He said Jeff Sessions was not a good choice of speakers. He shouldn't have been invited.
Quote, not the right speaker.
First of all, there are two problems with that.
Yeah.
The first is it's not the job of the president of a university to determine student speakers. Secondly, if you're going to weigh in, your only obligation is to weigh in on the other side, which is unless the person is the kind of threat that's prohibited by the First Amendment, then that person is welcome on our campus. And if students want to shout him down, we have rules that apply to those students. They can protest peacefully outside. That's what Martin Luther King, all the great civil disobedience people did. And then they take the consequences. And there should be consequences. I've been involved in this at the University of Chicago, which has good rules. And I'll tell you, there are two keys to the rules. The first is you must have good principles. Those have to be stated by the board of trustees, the president, the provost, and the principal.
Whatsoever things are true is not a good principle.
The key to the principles is you cannot say that social justice, feeling safe, those kinds of things ever get to override free speech. True physical danger. You can't come onto our campus and burn a cross if you're the Klan. You can't use a bullhorn at 2 a.m. next to our dormitories. There are rules about that. The second thing, and this is always missed, you have to have good principles, but those principles have to be implemented on the ground. It's not just what the speed limit says on the road signs. Those are set there by some higher up guy sitting or a woman sitting in a chair in Springfield or whatever. You have to have police who want to enforce traffic rules. And that belongs to the deans of students on every campus. They're the people who have people there on Thursday night at 7:30. It's not the president or the board of trustees.
Right.
And those people, unfortunately, are woke.
So the left has the cancel culture, Jeff and Charlie. They control it. The kids were raised to live and breathe social media where it's dominant, and the universities. They've been forced to bend their knee. Whether this kid, this editor who I didn't name because he's a kid,
right?
Whether he understands it or not, the cancel culture forced him to his knees to beg forgiveness. I wonder what future, and I'm just amazed by all the woke scolds in my own business who are saying, oh, how dare you?
Well, look at what happened at Harvard. Let's go to Harvard for just a second, because at Harvard there was a similar demonstration, not against him, but against, it was a demonstration against ICE, and I forget what prompted it, but after the demonstration,
Trump.
The Harvard student newspaper called the Crimson called, I mean, they got all the regular reporting, and then they called ICE for a comment, and students wanted the Crimson to take that down. They had violated the wokeness of the campus by calling for that. Crimson, to its credit, didn't do that, but Harvard student government condemned the Crimson for calling for them. They voted to condemn them.
I see a future, Jeff Carlin, that's dystopian and almost like a bad novel, like a derivative of Orwell, but it's coming. And the reason it's coming is because when your local school board, and everyone listening here, your local school board decides to get woke in the high school level and doesn't take out a teacher who is threatening the students with some sort of climate change religiosity, it happens. It's a slippery slope. And the if you can think of the deans at Oxford who warned that young runner, we do not have, the Olympics are not for professional athletics, and Oxford is not about professional athletics, and they were considered the fools in that movie called Chariots of Fire. And John Gielgud, the great Shakespearean actor, played one of the deans. And I thought popular literature and so forth isn't a time machine. And it tells us the nature of the time. And there it is.
I want to say, though, that we have had this and do have it from all different angles. I've known a lot of principals 20 years ago or superintendents of school districts in more conservative areas that had school boards that were not happy with a whole variety of curricula. So there's part of this has to do, when you get down to the K-12 area, with an unresolvable problem. And that is that professionals in schools want to control the curriculum, but parents want to raise their children, right?
Correct.
And so today that might relate to what age you begin to talk about transgender issues or something, but it's an unresolvable.
4 or 5.
Oh, well, I mean, why are you waiting?
Right,
why are you waiting, you know?
Cradle to the grave, that's what I say, yes.
But, I mean, there are appropriate ages for things and so forth. But the question is, there are always two questions about this. And one is, what are the rules? And the second question, which is often overlooked, is who decides? Who decides on these rules?
Colleges of education, sir. I'm taking the professor to school.
Oh, man.
But you know what? There are excellent ones. I will tell you one that's excellent. Concordia University.
Really?
Run by the Lutherans in River Forest. Right in Paul Rica's neighborhood, by the way, which is interesting. And I know because I know someone who went there. And it is really it's a good school. And there are others that are concerned about all these issues, but not enough. And at the big state schools that crank out the teachers that we saw on the picket line screaming at people and going to Venezuela to cheer on Maduro.
It's not just the teachers you have to worry they're cranking out. I mean, it's the lawyers, too, the ones who...
who kill them first.
Well, I've been... But it's the whole idea that all these higher learning places have become these moth-to-the-flame type establishments for liberal agendas, and you don't have enough. You know, you've got deans and provosts and all these people who have come in and are saying, well, who's giving us the money, and who do we want, and who do we want to appease, and they want to appease Hollywood. And all
Professor Lipson, we're at a point of the dark ages, I feel, and sooner or later we have to retreat to the monastery.
Boy, I feel that every time I come in the studio with you and Jeff, you know, that the dark ages are truly upon us.
I don't think they're upon us yet, but I think we need a monastery that we can go to where I'd like to see monks copying the Bible and the great books.
Fie Jesu Domine, dona eis requiem. Fie Jesu Domine.
And now we're back on this edition of the Chicago Way. If you like what you listen to, if you like hearing classical liberals, which is what we are, that's what I am. That's what Charles Lipson is and Jeff Carlin. We're called classical liberals for a reason. We're not right wingers. We're not left wingers. We're trying to enlighten you in this. And we want to enlighten you about the impeachment process as it moves forward. Professor, what should the country anticipate as every day we hear about Burisma and Hunter Biden, and every day there's a new Democrat announcing they're going to run for president because of it?
They expected the field to begin to narrow down now as the strong candidates came to the fore. And what they missed, the people who thought that would happen, is that if there weren't strong candidates coming to the fore, other people would see an opening. The only thing that's closing the opening at all is the filing dates for some of these primaries. What's happening in the House? I would say that the thing you need to watch most closely is whether or not the viewership and the public interest is going up or going down. If it goes down, what that tells you is that the public's attitude has been there, done that. It's not that some don't think Trump should be impeached and others think he should be not impeached.
Right.
But you need an overwhelming national majority who thinks that the president has done something so egregious that we cannot wait until next November, now less than a year away, for the sovereign people to make a decision. And right now, this is my own opinion, the Democrats have shown that there may have been something wrong, that Trump may have sought personal benefits rather than national benefits in what he was doing in Ukraine, but they have not shown that it was an urgent, big problem that needs the kind of draconian remedy that they are proposing.
If I may engage in a bit of sophistry here, the Democrats undercut their own argument.
How?
In that they want Trump impeached for getting himself involved and asking about Biden in Ukraine. But it was in Ukraine at the time of the Biden expansion of their wealth that many of these shenanigans about Russia collusion, et cetera, began.
That's why Adam Schiff is not allowing questions about the Bidens in Ukraine to be asked. The Democrats have inadvertently, by making this all about Ukraine, they've kneecapped what was their front-running candidate. But that doesn't mean that Trump is without problems. I get letters that criticize me from both sides because I've said what I said
yes,
earlier
I
here, namely that there were some problems in the call. It was not perfect, as Trump said, but that this is not the right remedy.
It's not the right remedy 11 months out from an election.
Right.
The long-term effect of that kind of thing to me is to cancel the 2016 election prematurely.
But that's what they've been trying
right.
to do for ever since the election.
But that's not a good prescription for the Republic.
That's true. And this is a very serious problem. We have people who, on both sides, who go beyond what I would call a legitimate concern. You have a 5,000 vote difference in a Kentucky election. You have a legal right to say, I want to see a recount. I want to make sure that, you know, everything was kosher here. But when you lose by 50,000 votes and years later, you still won't acknowledge the election right. and so forth, that begins to raise serious problems. And I should say that it goes beyond Stacey Abrams' refusal to acknowledge the legitimacy of the election in Georgia. You cannot be a leading Democrat who does not back Stacey Abrams' claim that she was illegitimately deprived of the office. I mean, she has some claims.
Yes.
I'm not saying that I have not
seen that proven up.
No, of course it hasn't been proven
up. It's rhetoric.
But in this case, because she's African-American and because it's such a critical constituency for the Democrats, they don't want to go up against against that constituency. So I understand that. But it is, as you said, a very troubling problem.
One aspect, Jeff and Professor, is that Deval Patrick is getting into the race. He doesn't get in the race, a wise man told me just a few minutes ago, without the blessing of the man that we're building the temple of love and fealty for, Barack Obama. So what does that do to Biden's candidacy?
It tanks it. I mean, he's no longer the sensible one, the one, you know, the nice guy, rock star, friend of Obama's, open change, holla. I mean,
Axelrod needs some more cash.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And I mean, he even said it himself, though, coming out, it's going to be an uphill battle. Well, yeah, it's a downhill battle for Biden, an uphill battle for him.
Do you agree, Charlie?
Jeff has got it exactly right. Let me, first of all, Biden looks fragile as a weak candidate. It's not his numerical age. Bernie, with a heart attack, for heaven's sake, looks like he's ready to rock and roll. Yeah. But and Trump looks strong. The age isn't an issue. The same is true for Elizabeth Warren. You can have your issues, but it's not about her age. It is an issue with Biden.
It's about that pemmican that I hope she passes out on the campaign trail.
But here's the problem. Biden could finish well out of the money in Iowa, and he may not win in New Hampshire. This is a bad start. His firewall was always going to be South Carolina. And why was it a firewall? He was going to have the black vote. Well, he was going to have it in part because the two African-American candidates, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, had faded so quickly. Right. But Deval Patrick may not. So the issue there will be, as they begin to look at the polling, do Biden's numbers begin to erode there?
So, in effect, Obama kneecaps Biden with Deval Patrick. And then who's the beneficiary? Deval Patrick? I don't think so.
The real likelihood, I've been saying it for months and months now, is that there'll be a tie on the first ballot at the Democratic convention. And that's partly because there's no obvious front runner, but it's also because the Democrats have picked what I would call a European system for how they're going to collect their votes. The whole Anglo-American system is first past the post. 51-49, you get all the votes, right? And the whole point of the system is to turn small voting majorities into large electoral majorities. The Democrats have decided to do it the opposite way, and you end up like what you end up with in Israel and every place else, which is every party gets a few votes, then you have to put together a coalition. That may work okay in a parliamentary system, but how's it going to work at a convention? Because the problem is, do the people who finish lower down feel that the winner is legitimate? I would say Bernie Sanders is not going to feel that way. He's going to feel it's been stolen twice.
And can you imagine
Milwaukee?
Yeah. Milwaukee is going to be fun because that's where the DNC is taking place. But can you imagine, though, that fodder laying at the feet of Donald Trump? I mean, going up against somebody who was in a second ballot compromise. I mean, then it's essentially over, because who's going to vote for that person when he comes out and says, oh, this is the best we got. You guys came up with this. I mean, old school politics don't matter here.
If it's Warren, I know what the polling shows, but I don't believe it. I don't believe people are honest about what they cancel culture has affected that as well.
Mister, we could use a man like Harry Truman again.
I think so.
That's what they're going to be singing in Milwaukee.
And you know what Harry Truman warned against after he left office? He warned against the deep state and the central, and had regrets, great regrets, about the Central Intelligence Agency that he started.
Fun fact: my uncle, through law, was Truman's personal secretary.
Really?
And he went to jail for Truman because of the deep state.
No kidding. And, well, tell me some more. Say some more.
Matthew Connolly is his name. Uh-huh. And he was, as a kid, I grew up, you know, loving this stuff. And my uncle, you know, this is slight side note, we had a cigar in a case that was given to his father by Winston Churchill. Like,
no kidding.
And my aunt and uncle,
I hope you didn't let Bill Clinton in the house.
And my aunt and uncle would get all the Christmas cards and, like, right, these fancy things from the White House.
Best would send.
Yeah. But so then this whole thing came down. It was about shifting funds and keeping a calendar the right way. And someone had to take a fall for it. And it wound up being my uncle's father. And Truman apologized to him after he got out. And, you know, he was, says, you know, and told, called his wife and said, hey, you know, as much my uncle's mom, and saying, you know, your husband's a good man, and even called my uncle and told my uncle was, you know, a young kid, you know, your dad's a good man. Don't feel bad about him. Don't think poorly of him. You know, he did his duty.
You know, it's
and fun. Then what yeah. was he made? I mean, you know, Truman's from the Prendergast machine. Yeah. Was he made whole?
From as far as I know, yeah.
Oh, really?
Truman was from the Prendergast machine in Kansas City.
Yeah.
But let me just say a couple of things about his integrity. The first thing is, Truman had a business partner after World War I, and they had a haberdashery. And the haberdashery, there was a kind of recession before the Great Depression, and they went broke. Truman was not obligated to pay off those debts. He spent 20-plus years paying off those debts for his partnership. He didn't have to. He did it. He was in charge of the county that Kansas City, Missouri is in. And his family, or his wife's family, had a farm. And he could have put roads through that farm and taken county money and really reaped some rewards. He did not. And then these are the quiet things. These are the things that don't happen. These are clients non-existent that are turned down by Chicago aldermen and sure. Members of the state legislature. When Prendergast died, I think by this point Prendergast had been in jail and so forth. In other words, the machine was crushed. Truman was either a vice president or the president. He went to the funeral, even though he knew that this guy had done bad things, had been rightly convicted, but he just was not going to be intimidated. And I think in a certain way, this links back to our discussion of cancel culture. We need a man like Harry Truman again, and we don't just need them at the top. We needed Mort Shapiro at Northwestern University to do that. We have such people at Chicago. Bob Zimmer does it. Dan Dearmeyer, our provost, does it. I don't want to get into the weeds, but I'll tell you who does it. The president of Purdue University, oh, Mitch yeah. Daniels.
My candidate for president. Damn it, Mitch.
Yes, and
riding your damn
so we
Harley.
Need those people, and we need them at the Harvard Crimson to say, buzz off, we're not going to do this. A little integrity will go a long way, a long way.
You know, sometimes there's nothing else to add, because that is pretty damn good. Thank you, Charlie, for being here.
Boy, that it is always so much fun.
Thanks, Charlie. We can't continue the Chicago way without talking to Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, who just a few days ago had this killer story about Michael Madigan's top Yago confidant, Michael McLean, lobbyist for Madigan Electric, or you might call it ComEd, and how his phone's been wired. And then just, you know, I don't know, in a blink of an eye, after that story comes out, and maybe a column about get on the federal bus or not, or get off the federal bus, guess who just resigned? John Cullerton, Johnny Cullerton, president of the Senate, 40 years in the State House. And Ray Long has covered him for years. Ray.
Hey. Hey, baby.
Hey, baby.
It's been a long ride. I think he started in 78. I started covering that place in 81. So I've seen the rise. I've seen him be an ally of Michael Madigan himself. And I thought it was very curious timing that he left when he did.
Now, I'm taping this on a weekday before the weekend, but are we going to see anything in the next paper in the next day or two after this, and I'm going to be like, oh crap.
No, I don't know of anything that links John Cullerton to the massive investigation, but he does have three guys in his chamber who have been caught up in it, and one is Terry Link, the Tribune, identified him as a guy who wore a wire during this investigation, and he's the senator from Lake County. And then, of course, we have Marty Sandoval, the Democrat from Chicago, whose Senate district overlaps Mike Madigan's district in the House. And then we've got Tom Cullerton, the distant cousin of John Cullerton, the Senate president who just resigned. So, you know, John Cullerton became president of the Senate. The first thing he did was put together a trial for Rod Blagojevich. And that's how he started his reign as presidency. And he's leaving now with another big federal investigation burgeoning in Springfield.
The John Cullerton. I always identify him, you know, how in the straight news pages, you guys identify him like John Cullerton, D, comma, what is it, Chicago, right? Northwest
Chicago.
Side.
Yeah.
And, and how I identify him is John Cullerton, D hyphen DeLeo.
And of course, you're talking about the famous Senator DeLeo, who's now retired.
Now retired, and I hear he's become a king of Rosemont, and had, I guess, something to do with John Cullerton becoming Senate president. I think he had some influence back in those days. Maybe he had lobbied for him to say, hey, John's a good guy. You might want to vote for him.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I'm sure he was a supporter of John Cullerton. There's no doubt about it. And Jimmy DeLeo was able to find his way as a kind of go-between between the legislature and the mayor and Mayor Daley and Rod Blagojevich, the governor. And
mm-hmm.
He was a player for sure, and he always made himself part of the game.
And now the John Cullerton legacy is what? Besides a piece of Tavern on Rush, a business involving Lincoln Title, which one of his partners is Jimmy DeLeo, then his wife, and Eddie Jensen's son, the criminal lawyer who has represented the mafia, the father has. What else is there? 40 years of sound fiscal policy? Because does he get any credit for the fact that we're almost broke, or did he not say that this is not a big? Didn't he say a couple of years ago this is not a big deal? It's not really that worrisome.
Well, he's been in a top slot there during the entire situation where the state's fiscal state deteriorated. Now, he, of course, has tried to do some things to shore it up. He pushed through some tax increases, income tax increases, to help shore it up. He also worked to try to put together a plan with labor that had labor's endorsement that would have attempted to cut into that gigantic $100 billion plus pension deficit that the state has, but he couldn't move it past the House where Madigan wouldn't take that plan up. Madigan passed a different one. Cullerton went ahead and approved it in his chamber, and the Supreme Court then threw it out, and we've basically been in a holding pattern since.
And to just to be fair and specific, I know we keep saying resigned.
Did I say resigned? I'm sorry.
Yeah, we did, but it's the potato in a sense where he's retiring in January.
Yeah, and he's I'm just saying I'm humming
with this. Or
yeah, go on. I just wanted to hum a little song from childhood. Go on.
Yes. And he probably was, if not the most prolific legislator as far as passing bills, among the most. But he could be recognized for things like traffic safety efforts and helmet laws that he tried to push through but never could get through for motorcycles. You know, Illinois is one of the few states in America where you can still ride your motorcycle without your helmet. But he also, was on the side where if there were goodies in a pension bill, he was often one of the ones who was sponsoring that bill. So there's good and bad about John Cullerton. He stood up. But he is one of those politicians who has made a career of it and has tried to make things happen. I mean, when the Tribune pushed for exposed some of the flaws in the death penalty, and the editorial board was pushing for changes in the death penalty, he was pushing through legislation that addressed those types of issues. So he has stood up on some of the major issues and taken heat for some of his decisions along the way.
And it's those kinds of things that have endeared him to members of the media in the opinionating culture, right? I mean, he's been, it's like Madigan, in a way, it's like Madigan wouldn't talk to them. So, but you could always call Johnny, and Johnny would give you the lowdown, right? It's just very interesting how they played it, the two of them.
There's some of that, yeah. And I think Kellerton was more interested in reforms than the speaker was, and so they had that kind of tension going on, too. He also had to appease a caucus, too. He just didn't do exactly what Madigan said. His caucus wouldn't let him all the time. So he had to remain in charge of that caucus. He had to also do what the caucus wanted him to do sometimes. And sometimes that meant passing bills that Madigan didn't want. Now, a lot of times they didn't get past Madigan's chamber, but they could make their point from the Senate, and sometimes that's all you can do.
The two things I want to ask you about. One, it's like no one's going to, I don't think people are going to remember, maybe a few of us, you would, I would, Tom Serafin, other old-timers, that when it came time to take, the Democratic Party wanted to take out the old lion, the great old lion on the Northwest side, Dan Russinkowski, Johnny Culleton found himself oddly running in a Democratic primary against him.
Yeah, that was one strange chapter. He even, as you and I will recall, he even mailed out shell casings, as I recall, bullet casings. I'm remembering that right.
When they took Russ, he mailed bullets out to constituents. That was his stunt. His real trick was undercutting Russinkowski, who was already going to be nailed by Eric Holder, by the way, young prosecutor, federal prosecutor, Eric Holder. So they take him out. And then who becomes the big rainmaker from Chicago? None other than Bill Daley. Just worked out fine. It's almost like, I don't know, Ray, like a coincidence, you know?
And we all know there's a lot of coincidence.
Now, who's going to, what about the speculation? Have they chosen a replacement? Has Madigan chosen a replacement for his mini-me yet?
Well, I wasn't down there, but I read our report from there, from our colleagues, and one of the people that they're talking about is Don Harmon of Oak Park, who was a close confidant of Kellerton, obviously. And Harmon's a lawyer who has carried some of the more difficult packages, and he's carried some of the things like immigration type bills and labor bills, et cetera. And some of the more attempts at least at reform he was negotiating.
How about Tony Munoz?
Well, that's another. I'm sure there's 59 or 58 other senators right now who think that they ought to be the Senate president. So I'm not sure it's a clear cut. I mean, there are smart guys in there like Andy Menar, who may be a person that the caucus could turn to. Maybe it's time for an African American. Kim Lightford has been there and has held sway over that caucus in many ways for years. So there are others out there who may come in and be able to rally their own set of forces.
And as we wrap things here, too, circling back on the resignation thing, which I we kind of trickled on, one of the comments that you think about, or people think about, why this is such an odd thing, and resignation is essentially what it is, even though he says retirement, is because, you know, he's very
thoughtful in what he does. And so there was with just doing this out of the blue, somebody who's been, like you guys have said, has had a storied career.
He's talked about it before.
Right. But to just all of a sudden happen. I mean, this is one of those things where you don't do it on the last day of a veto session. You know, there's a discussion, there's a party. I mean, there's more to it, usually more pomp and circumstance, if you will.
He's talked about it before, though, yeah. Hasn't he, Ray?
I mean, I think he's been thinking about it. He's 71. And so, the trip to Springfield after 40 years can probably wear on you, right? But
yeah, especially when you're driving your own car as opposed to being in a big bus, you know?
Yeah, or a plane. So they cut most of those flights out under Rauner, the flights that went from Chicago to Springfield. Now, I guess I'll have to check and see if they're reinstated, but the reality is that he's going out right now at a time that the legislature is still kind of nervous, right? They're nervous about the investigations that are going on and some of their own members. There was just a Louis Arroyo in the House got charged with bribery. And so this is an active investigation, and we just learned this last week that one of the most powerful lobbyists in the state was wired up. So, not wired up, but tapped. And so it's an odd time to be leaving, but I'm sure it'll be one he'll be glad to put the Capitol in the rearview mirror.
I'll tell you one thing, Ray. At least he's got a great pension. Think of that. He'll be making money in his pension than he made in his salary, because that's the Chicago way, and that's the Springfield way. It's just a great deal for him, and it's wonderful that he can leave on his own accord and get all the accolades. Ray Long, you and Jason Meisner and all of our colleagues at the Chicago Tribune have been killing it on these stories.
Thank you, man.
I just can't, you know, I mean, McLean wired, that sent shockwaves through all of Springfield. It's like people thought about it, but when you read it, page one above the fold, it's a huge deal. Thanks, well, Ray. Know, well, yeah.
You know, one guy told me that his cell phone text messages lit up as soon as we put it out there on our website, that five people texted in that story within 5 minutes. So, you know, that gives you a feel for how it resonated in Springfield.
And Madigan Electric is just one part of a larger, huge, rolling investigation. If you want to follow Ray Long, follow him at Ray Long, because every politician, wise guy and criminal lawyer is following him and lobbyist. So thanks a lot, Ray. Thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. All right. Appreciate it, John.
Love you, baby.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Yep. See you, baby.
Thanks, Ray.
And so for Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, with that great insight into Johnny Cullerton, the mini-me of Mike Madigan, and for Professor Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, for his great insight on Harry Truman, cancel culture, the impeachment of Trump that is kneecapping Joe Biden, and for Jeff Carlin and his uncle's father, who went to prison for Harry Truman. Amazing, Jeff. And for me, I'm John Cass, husband, father, worried about the cancel culture that's destroying our universities and forcing young journalists to their knees. And once you kneel, you put your head down and you apologize. That's not American. For another edition of the Chicago Way, thanks for being here, everybody. And if you like what you hear, find us on iTunes or elsewhere. Subscribe, write us killer reviews, share it with your friends, because you're not going to hear anything like this anywhere else.